This is the Bible Show. Welcome, folks, to another episode of the Bible Show. My name is Sam Kasten-Smith. Joining me today is Will, and we are continuing our series in the book of Genesis. Today we get to the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, which becomes super famous whenever you hear that. Like, what jumps to mind?
I mean, it's the first, like, real wrath of God we see.
Yeah, so apart from the flood.
Yeah, okay, I even forget that. But most people don't even go back to that. They think this one's the one where it's like...
Yeah, this is like angry God. Like, you get the sense, like, this is God bringing the wrath, and it's for particular story that you can tie to. Like, with the flood, you hear that the world is evil, it's doing lots of bad stuff.
Yeah, but then everybody's like, bad, but yeah, one guy.
But what does that even look like? With Sodom, it's like, hey, here is a particular city with real people that have shown up before in the Bible, and they're engaging in sins that God is really unhappy with. And so, like, just before we start, like, let me kind of categorize this. When we were in Genesis 18 last time, God comes and he says that the outcry against Sodom was, like, their sins were very grave. The outcry makes it up to him. And, like, because we don't know the history of that culture, most people don't, they're like, oh, well, you know, everybody else was good, and Sodom's this wicked city, and so their outcry comes up because, you know, these people are nice all around Sodom. Yeah. And the reality is, like, no, the whole region is unbelievably wicked. We know that for sure. Like, let me just give you some of the basis for why I say that.
Is this one where we need to put disclaimer on?
We'll get to the disclaimers. We're okay so far. Okay. We'll get to the disclaimers. By the way, like, if you want to listen to this before you bring your kids in, that might be wise. But we'll try to remember to be like, all right, if you have kids, this is coming to a portion that's going to be, you know, rated PG-17 or whatever it is. Anyway, the people in the land of Canaan are crying out over how wicked Sodom is, which is wild because the Canaanites were known for, well, I guess this is kind of adult, cult prostitution, child sacrifice.
Yeah.
They're doing things that are unbelievably wicked, even to the point where when, like, we're going to see in a few chapters down the road where when Abram's like, you know what, I really need to find a bride for my son Isaac. Well, there's civilizations all around, right? Like, yeah, just pick one from the local city. Why not? He's like, no. He cannot marry any of the families within a radius of hundreds of miles. I want my servant to go all the way back to the land of Haran to find a bride for Isaac because the Canaanites were so nasty. And we also need to remember that in Genesis 9, what does God say? Cursed be Canaan. And for whatever reason, all of these different tribes that come out of the line of Canaan end up being really, really wicked. And the outcries coming from them against Sodom. So now it's like, among the wicked, like the really wicked cultures that Abraham's like, whoa, too wicked for my son Isaac. Among them, the outcry is like, Sodom's in another class. Mm. Like, the wickedness that's coming out of that city, like, whoa, too much. And so God is coming down, and he is going to destroy the city. And we pick up in Genesis chapter 19, and this is going to be a message. We're going to hit on God's justice, his wrath, his mercy, his patience with very stupid people and stubborn people. It's a warning against sin and sexual chaos. We're going to see that it's a very stark warning about making compromises with sin. We're going to see one of the cool things about Sodom is you'll see that Sodom lays down the story of its judgment, lays down the pattern for, like, all the major judgments to come, even the apocalypse and the second coming of Jesus, the pattern for it. And even Jesus will invoke the judgment of Sodom and Lot's wife when he's talking about his second coming. So, like, there's a lot to unpack there. How can we know about the second coming based on what we're about to see here? It's a warning against self-righteousness and religiosity and pride and a lack of charity and a lack of hospitality. Like, there's so much in this where God is saying, hey, my holiness, I will not be mocked. I will not allow civilization. My grace and mercy, like, you've watched it, from Genesis 12 with Abraham and how he keeps stumbling and doing dumb things and kind of gross things, and Sarah does and Hagar does and Lot does. Like, and I've been patient all along, and then all of a sudden this chapter, it's like, whoa, God is not playing anymore. What do you do with that? So let's jump right in. And it says those two angels that had dispatched. So Abraham's having a conversation with God, and Abraham's like, please, will you save Sodom? Like, what if there's righteous people there? And God's like, if there's righteous people there, I'll save it. But the two angels leave, and they're on their way, right?
And that's the first time they're called angels. So they were just men before. So now the Bible's made it clear, like, okay, those two guys were really angels.
Yeah, there's a reason why Abraham runs and is bowing down, yeah. Like, this is the Lord and two angels. He knew that in Genesis 18. Well, now those two angels, we're told, came to Sodom in the evening. And Lot was sitting in the gate of Sodom. Now, we could read right past that, but that is immensely important to the story. Do you know why?
Yeah, because that means Lot has something to do with their people.
That's right.
Authority now. He's an elder, sits at the gate.
That's right. If you go and you look through the Bible, whenever it refers to the gates of the city, it's talking about, like, this is the leadership. These are the people who make the judgments. This is where the center of commerce is. This is like the city hall is the gates. And so you watch Lot's progression through the story. In Genesis 13, when, you know, their possessions are growing and their herds are growing and everything is, you know, they're like, whoa, we have too much to share. And Lot sees Sodom and it's beautiful.
It's
we're
green.
Told. Yeah, it's green. It's like the garden of the Lord. And he chooses to go towards Sodom, but it says he pitched his tents toward Sodom, which means what? He's not in the city.
Yeah.
But he's drawing near to it. You know, the next time we learn anything happening with Lot is in chapter 14 when these kingdoms come through and they conquer all the Sodomites and they take them off into captivity. And somehow Lot got caught up in that, which means he's identifying enough with Sodom to where he got conquered and captured along with all the people of Sodom. So maybe he's not in a tent that's a little bit of a distance away from Sodom. Maybe now he's in the midst
of Sodom.
He's a Sodomite now. But when it says not just that he's at the gate, but this is really important, he is sitting at the gate, which means he's got a seat now in the gates of Sodom, which means he's gone from somebody who's flirting with Sodom to somebody who identifies in Sodom and gets captured, to now it's like he's considered a respected elder. You don't sit in the city, in the gates of a city, unless you've risen through the ranks and you have some bit of respect and notoriety as an elder or a judge of the city. Like later on, they're going to say, "Who you know, you became a judge of the city," and you think, "Are they joking, or is it like he's judgy?" No, he's like actually, I think that means that. I think he's got an office here. I think he's now not just tangential to Sodom. He's in Sodom and of Sodom.
Yeah, cause that's weird because our culture, it almost seems like almost everything, except for like real judges, everything authoritative we stand for. Mm-hmm. Now you even think in churches, like the pastor's the one standing and we're all sitting. It's like the reversal of what's going on here. But now you think about a court case. Yeah, every video you see a judge is sitting when he makes a declaration.
Yeah, that's right. All rise.
It's not like everyone rise, let me stand up too.
Right. That's true. And so, like, and by the way, I'm not saying that Lot is as wicked as the city of Sodom. What I am saying is he's made one compromise after the next to where he's like, you know what, I could live here.
He's had to overlook a bunch.
You know, I don't like what they do. You'll see, he doesn't like what they do, but I could be here. I make a really good living. This city is super, super great at commerce, you know. I don't love it, but I could be here. And to the point where now he's, in a sense, an exalted person in their society. So it says, when Lot saw them, so he sees these angels coming, and he knows something about them. Like, it's kind of weird. Like, how does he know them? That's one of the questions that's left to our imaginations. But it says he rose to meet them and bowed himself with his face to the earth. Now, there's hospitality, and then there's this.
Yeah, it's not like, come on in.
You're bowing yourself with your face to the earth. It's a clear demonstration that I am your servant. I am in submission to you. He knows something is different about these guys, which then it like begs the question, is this a spiritual insight that they have? You know, because it doesn't seem like the men of Sodom are like, whoa, these guys are different. Yeah. We should be reverential or fearful at least because they're angelic, you know. they treat them like people to be abused. But Lot recognizes something about them, which then makes you wonder, like, does he have, is there something about them that's physically different? Or does Lot have some kind of a spiritual insight as to who they are? I don't know.
And it's just like Abraham did. So he has whatever Abraham had too.
That's right.
So there's a connection there. Like, Lot hasn't fully walked away, it seems, from the family of Abraham.
But, man,
he's about as far away as you can get.
He is messy, as we're going to see in this episode and the next episode. So he went out to meet them, bowed himself with his face to the earth, and said, "My lords, please turn aside to your servant's house and spend the night and wash your feet, that you may rise up early and go on your way." So he's like, you can't be out here. You're like, come to my house quick. You know, I'll show you hospitality. I'll take care of you. And they said, no, we'll spend the night in the town square. And how would that have gone?
For them?
I mean, like,
just wait and see.
In Lot's mind, he's like, you can't.
Yeah, Lot's the scared one here, which shows you the state of all of this.
That's right.
That he's the one with all the info, and he's like, hey, you guys are, this is not going to be good for you. Mm-hmm. I'm okay. I'm sitting here at the gate. I'm worried about you guys.
Yeah, and so here, like, there's so very little. The New Testament will refer to Lot as being righteous, as to Lot as being righteous. And you're like, okay, let me come up with a list. What does he do that's righteous? Okay, this is one of them.
Yeah.
He sees these two men, these two strangers, and he knows how wicked the town is, and he doesn't like it. So he's like, no, you can't be out here. So he pressed them strongly, verse 3. So they turned aside to him and entered his house, and he made them a feast and baked unleavened bread, and they ate. So like Abraham, you know, he's not making the feast to feed hundreds, but, you know, he's giving them bread, and here's some.
Well, he's trying to expedite their visit. He's like, let's get you fed and get you out of here.
That's an interesting point, because we talked about how Abraham's like, stay a
slow crawling this.
Yeah, Lot's like, all right, you're going to eat, you're going like, to sleep, get out of here. Yeah, that's right. So Lot's panicked, and there's like no doubt that he feels an urgency. There's new men in this town. This is not going to go well. You get his anxiety here.
And we know the end of the story, but even if you're reading this for the first time, you notice that, like, this isn't good.
Yeah.
Like, I know why it's not good, so I get that it's not good, so I understand his feelings. But if you're just this far in the story and you're like, this is the first time hearing this, this is weird behavior for a guy who's the elder of a city.
Yeah, if I come to somebody's house and they're like, no, you need to get in now. Get inside. I'm like, what's going on in this neighborhood?
It's a little purgy for me.
That's true. So verse 4, it says, but before they lay down. So they don't even make it through the evening. They don't, you know, dinner is just done. They lay down, and the men of the city, the men of Sodom, and then listen to this. This is how wicked this town is. Both young and old, all the people to the last man surrounded the house. So when Abraham's haggling with God, being like, but what if there's righteous people here?
It's making it clear.
There's not. Every man, young, old, all the people, to the last man, surrounded the house. And so when all these people come and they say, where are the men who came to you tonight? Bring them out to us that we may know them. What they are not doing, what they're not saying is, hey, we'd like to get to know them and be good neighbors. Warning, like, if you're a parent, now is the time to pause it, because the story gets gets very adult here. When you find in the scriptures where it says that we may know them, or Adam knew his wife Eve and she conceived and bore a son, this is sexual language going on here. The Hebrew word is yada, which is like a Seinfeld inside joke, yada yada. If you know that joke where Elaine is talking, she says yada yada is, anyway, let's probably edit that out.
That one landed.
Yeah.
I've never seen that show.
All right. I guess it's too old for you. Seinfeld is archaic for you.
It is.
Millennial. Anyway, it's experiential knowledge. And so they're saying, bring out these men. Essentially, we want to rape them. And so when God says, I'm going to see how wicked they are, mm-hmm. I'm going to see if their sin has come to a completion. Here you see every man has been corrupted in this whole city, with the exception of Lot, who does not like this idea. But Lot's pretty corrupt too. He's pretty fallen, and he's compromised with sin a lot. But now you see they are willing to do this to ambassadors from heaven. All right, so we're going to get into it a little bit more, but there's a theory out there from some scholars about what's actually going on here, and it's compelling. There was an archaeologist who went over there and got permission from the Jordanian government to dig up a site where he thought Sodom should be. So he's using the Bible. He knows where Abraham and Lot were when Lot looked across and saw this place, and so he's like, okay, well, if Abraham and Lot were here and it's within eyesight, it's got to be in that direction. So he goes over there, finds a great, what's called a tal in Jordan, or a tel in Israel, which is the ruins of an ancient city that are covered up and it looks like a massive hill, right? Mm-hmm. He digs it up and he finds a city that, for all indications, it matches Sodom. Like, it's just spot on. We're going to get into a lot of that as we go through the episode. That's so fascinating what they found there that seems to just verify the Bible exactly as it's told. But one of the things that they find there, where he's like, this is entirely different than everything Canaanite. Like, he finds, as you're looking at where the palace was in the city, that there's pillared architecture, right? There's pillars there. You don't find that in Canaanite architecture. Hmm. You find that in, like, architecture from the Aegean and ancient Mycenae or Minoan culture. You find columns there. And so he's like, well, this is different. Maybe this is why the Canaanites are different, why the outcry against them is even different than what the Canaanites were. They're altogether different than what the Canaanites are. And so he's like, pillared architecture, they didn't do that there. They didn't do it in Egypt at this point, or at least not this type. And so he's like, I think this was influenced by Aegean culture. And then they start finding artifacts that show an obsession with the bull. You know, and they find like the head of a bull with the horns turned down. And that was always something that the Minoans loved because the Minoans revered the bull. So think the Minotaur from Greek mythology. Yeah. What's the Minotaur?
Half bull, half man.
Half bull, half man, right? So they revered the bull. And a downward facing bull was the image that they would do for bull leaping, where a bull's charging at you and you have their like matador equivalent that would run at the bull, leap over the head of the bull, do a somersault off the back, and you find ancient artwork showing this all over the world. But the Minoans were obsessed with that, so you find a downward-headed bull because they did bull leaping. You find phallic artifacts, which are, you know, not great. But all of that is pointing you to the Minoan culture. And so then this archaeologist, Collins, is like, maybe this helps us to make sense of what's going on here with this really gross behavior. And so he goes and he's looking at ancient records, and one of the historians, Strabo, who wrote on geography, he chronicles what used to happen with the Minoan culture and how they would bring young boys into full citizens. And so this is really disturbing. But this was their practice in the ancient world. In the Minoan culture, they would wait for a boy to become kind of the age of adulthood, right around the age of 12. And what they would do is they would organize a party of kidnappers. They would arrange it like parents knew about it, but the friends would keep it secret. And a party of kidnappers would come and kidnap a 12-year-old boy. He would be assigned to somebody that was going to be like his one-on-one mentor. They would go off on like a honeymoon out into the wilderness, where this older man was going to show this younger boy how to be a man, and then they would come back. But it was understood that while they were together, the older man would have all access to this young boy. Oof. And when they got back, if there was a good report for the younger boy, he was presented with the emblems of what it meant to be a citizen of the city, a cup that you would, you know, share in the civic meetings, a bull, you know, that showed that you had your own possessions and a couple other things. But he would also come back and give a report as to what happened with the older man and whether or not it was good or bad. Mm. And the most disgusting kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And so his theory, Collins's theory, is like, okay, if this was the entry into adulthood, if this was the entry into citizenship in the Minoan culture, and over here we see that this city looks to have lots of Minoan influence. It's different than the Canaanite cities. Even in the scripture, it's like something's off about this city, way worse than the Canaanites. And you have a town that's like, hey, we've got these new people here.
Yes.
And all the men of the city, young and old, all of them are in on it together. They come and demand to know them. he thinks that maybe that this was a distorted continuation of that practice where everybody in the city had to go through this initiation rite. And here come these two people into the city, unbeknownst to them, angels, that they're demanding to abuse. And you could, even the Canaanites of the area would have looked at that and been horrified. So it's a theory, but as you consider it, like, I think it's a compelling theory. I wouldn't stake my salvation on it, and I won't say, thus saith the Lord, you know, this is reality. But it certainly helps.
It makes a lot of sense.
To
for
make
a whole
more sense
city to be so distorted that every man has gone through this ritual that it just supposed that, hey, this is going to continue on and on forever. We all think this way. This is how it happens. It would make sense that there would be no naysayers if this is the culture.
That's right. So really incredibly disturbing here.
And why it would make sense that Lot is so horrified as a new citizen to the city.
Yeah. And he's sitting there going, you can't be here. No. Newcomers, you don't want to be here. We got to hide you. Like, either the city is filled with such a demonic, overwhelming compulsion to lust that the people are just beyond self-control and this wicked, which is totally possible. It's the way I've always read the story. Or this is some tradition and, in a sense, is more wicked because it forces anyone who wants a say in the city to be abused and to lose any innocence or purity, particularly with regard to sex. Either way, it's absolutely
it's
horrific.
It's all gross.
It's horrific. So, you know, here you have the men coming, and they're demanding, you know, this awful perversity. All right, so in verse 6, like, you see a glimmer of some righteous parts of Lot's character, right?
Yeah.
So it says, Lot went out to the men at the entrance, and he shut the door after him. So here's Lot who's saying, hey, to protect these angels, I'm willing to endanger myself.
Yeah, I'm going to the crowd.
I've already endangered myself by saying, come hide in my house. But now I'm going out to these savage, gross men, and I'm shutting the door to keep them safe inside. And now I'm out, and I'm endangering myself. And he says, I beg you, my brothers, which is like, probably not the best thing to call people in this city. But he identifies with them, obviously. I beg you, my brothers, do not act so wickedly. So you see, like, he's looking at this. Lot has not drifted to where his conscience is this dead, to where he'd be like, I'm good with this.
Yeah, like, keep going.
He thinks it's repulsive. And so you're like, oh, okay, maybe Lot has some good in him here. Like, great. And then verse 8 comes and sweeps the legs right out under you.
Maybe the worst one.
It is the worst. It's awful. Like, because this is the verse where I'm like, how do you reconcile this with someone who has even the smallest concern for God or faith or anything? Listen, let's just get to it. Verse 8, it says, Lot's pleading with them. And before they even have a chance to respond, like, it's not like he's negotiating. It's just like his first offer. He says, behold, I have two daughters who have not known any man. So he's raised up his daughters with a sexual ethic, interestingly, inside the city of Sodom, and yet to protect these two angelic visitors, which is like man thinking that he needs to protect God, right? Like, yeah. Oh, you know, he doesn't say, here I am, you know, abuse me. I'll offer up myself. He says, here's my daughters. And as two guys who have daughters, it's like unthinkable to me. And it's one of those areas where, like, God's grace is just so big that he doesn't say, all right, I'm burning the town with you in it. Yeah. If that's who you are, I'm done with you, because that's like the instinct that everybody listening to this probably has, which is like, what a gross person. But I have to say, like, I think his heart is, these beings from God Almighty are more important than anything. So
yeah, that's the only way you could look at it in a semi-decent perspective.
But this will also inform where we go next week, to where these daughters have no boundaries of sexual ethic. They have no boundaries on the character of God. They have, there's nothing that they understand that points to the dignity that they have as being made in his image. Like, we're going to see they are
The product of
really
Sodom.
Corrupt.
Yeah, they're not shocking. We shouldn't be shocked when we get to that chapter. You will be, but it's not shocked that they came out of Sodom.
But it's like you see the dominoes of sin here. So Lot starts compromising with sin, and he's going to raise a family not just outside Sodom, not just being a member of Sodom, but being somebody who's in the gates. Like, by essence, by being a part of it, he's endorsed this to his family, all this sexual dysfunction that's going around. And you look at the daughters, and like when we read this story, we're like, oh, these poor virtuous daughters, you know, they're... No, these daughters end up being wicked as all get out. They're not little children. They're grown adults, but it shows why are they the way that they proved to be that we'll see next week? Well, it's because Lot brought and began compromising with the ethics of the world for the sake of chasing money and industry and everything else. And now his house is corrupted because he made all those little compromises one at a time. And imagine being a daughter who has a dad that's willing, you know, he's compromised by moving into Sodom. He's compromised by raising you up in Sodom. And now you see that he's even willing to compromise with you. Like, it's, I don't know, lots of complex character. Like, to know that he's in heaven, like, my brain has to go, okay, there's something righteous that happened to him after all of the stories end with him. Because in my mind, I want the people that are going to be in heaven to be good people who earn it.
Yeah, no.
And if there's ever a story in the Bible that's like, this guy's in heaven? Like, God calls him righteous? Yeah, I don't know what happens. I mean, we see little glimmers of his faithfulness here and there.
But you have to really look for those. He does. Lots of great test case for faith alone.
Ooh, he does some stuff that is, it's rough to reconcile. Like, one day I'm going to have to stand in heaven in front of Lot and be like, sorry, I mean, I really dogged you, but this was messy.
Or just, like, explain to me some gaps.
Praise Jesus that he can save the, you know, the farthest outcast and the most messed up people. You know, that's why we'll be there talking to Lot. But, man, what a test case here. He says, let me bring them out to you, and you do to them as you please. Only do nothing to these men, for they have come under the shelter of my roof.
And nothing happens to the daughters here.
Yeah, yeah.
So let's just clear that up before anybody starts to wonder.
But again, like, okay, you bring up a great point, because all through this, the men that are supposed to take care of the women always take the shortcut. The women end up being put in a bad situation.
God has to save them.
And God has to save them. What happens here?
Same.
Same thing. You have Lot being like, here, how about them? You know, we'll take comfort. We'll be safe. Just take them. And it's always God, it's always heaven that has to come down and be like, what are you doing? Like, lead, protect them. You're meant to be the protector. Step up. And then it's heaven who comes to the rescue.
And this is one of those reasons why I think the theory you brought up about the mentorship or whatever we call it.
The Minoan
stuff. Because they don't take the offer of the two girls.
Yeah, that is interesting.
It's an equitable trade right now. They could say, oh, we like that deal. They could walk away with Lot's two daughters. These men are perfectly safe, but they're adamant. They don't even wonder, but they don't even like deal back.
Gross.
They're just like, no, we don't want women.
Gross. Gross, gross, gross. All right, so verse 9, but they said, so here you have the angels that are like, oh, Lot, no, that's not allowed. Stand back. And they said, so now you have all these men of Sodom that are looking at this situation. And they're looking at Lot. So now let's remember Lot's story. Because if the whole Minoan thing is right, how is Lot in the gates, right?
He went through it.
Well, that's what you would think. But maybe right now is what they're saying. And it says, they said, this fellow came here to sojourn. Like, he came in with a green card. He didn't become a full citizen. But now he's become the judge. He sits in our city gates. And now he's turning on us. Now he's bad-mouthing our traditions. Well, then, we're going to deal with you worse than with them. You think we were going to put them through something. Now we're coming after you. You got in because, you know, yeah, your Uncle Abraham spared the whole city and rescued us when we were conquered. We gave you special benefits. We let you come in. Now you're bad-mouthing us? Oh, well, then we're going to deal with you worse than them. And now the angels come and protect Lot. It says that all the men then pressed hard against the man Lot and drew near to break the door down. And this gets to another point. Like, evil never compromises. Like, Lot's going, but what, you know, how about, you know, let's make a deal. Evil always just says, thank you very much, and I'm still going to conquer the rest of you.
Take it all.
You'll compromise it and be like, no, 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 I'm going to remain godly. I'm not going to become like Sodom. And before you know it, you're raising a family that's so thoroughly corrupted by what you've surrounded them with and what you've normalized them with. And Lot is about to go through a very hard season of his life because of these little compromises all along the way. You know, where he's like, ooh, look at the money over there. Yeah, that'll go well for me. His whole life has been tragedy after tragedy because he chased after those idols. Interesting, interesting. So they're pressing hard against Lot to break the door down. But the angels, the men, reached out their hands, brought Lot into the house with them, and then shut the door. Hold on to that. Remember that. They shut the door.
The door.
And they struck the blindness, struck with blindness the men who were at the entrance of the house, both small and great, so that they wore themselves out groping for the door. The idea is, like, this is just more than a normal blindness where it's like that many people, they're going to find the door. Like, there's something going on here where they are supernaturally disabled, not just with sight, but they never will get in. They are disabled. They cannot get there. And so here, I want you to take special note that God provides salvation behind a door. We're going to come back to that. So then, verse 12, then the men said to Lot, have you anyone else here? So these angels are still going, you know, you're wicked. We had to save you, but now we're going to offer you an extension of mercy. Is there anyone else in this place that could even remotely possibly have a microscopic mustard seed of faith that would believe you if you offered them salvation?
Yeah, it's Noah's clause.
It's go preach. Like, free anybody who will come, we will rescue. Lot, it's up to you. Do you have anyone else here? And sons-in-law, sons, daughters, anyone you have in the city, bring them out of this place. For we are about to destroy this place because the outcry against its people has become great before the Lord, and the Lord has sent us to destroy it.
And they confirm, remember, when God's like, I'm going to send these two just to make sure the outcry is still great. Well, this is the clearest confirmation you can get that the outcry was credible.
Yes, yes. This is a very, very wicked city. It is ready for destruction. But how wild. I want you to stop for a moment. This is going on. Just think how crazy this is. This is the ethos of heaven. You have men that are seeking to rape the angels that have been sent to bring destruction. And the ethos of these angels sent from heaven is there anyone here who will take mercy?
Yes.
Even as they're doing that, like, you want to extend, because remember, Lot's sons-in-laws, if it says that every man in the city was in the crowd,
they're there.
Guess who else is in the crowd? And they're like, anyone? Anyone want mercy? Like, anyone that would agree to come with you? Mercy's available to them. Huh? God, like, sometimes don't you feel like in the fleshly, stupid part of you that you're like, God, you're too merciful. Like, just bring down the fire, like, them?
They shouldn't even send those angels in.
And God's like, even in the midst of judgment, he's like, mercy? Anyone? Lot? Do you know anyone? Like, mercy? Because I'll extend it. Even though they're unworthy, by definition, mercy. Like, anyone?
And is he clarifying the intercession of Abraham here and, like, almost kind of proving to Abraham that this had to happen?
Yeah.
Like, he's not getting to 10 with this group.
Yeah, no. There's this many. Right? I mean, righteous Lot is only righteous by the extension of what Christ has granted him by the modic little tiny bit of faith that he has. Like, there's no one that's truly righteous in this place. Even Lot has proven unworthy of the mercy that he's going to receive. He says, they say, we're about to destroy it. The Lord has sent us to destroy it. And so Lot goes out. And this is like, okay, here you see, like, Lot is like,
he went right outside his door because his sons-in-law were there. This conversation went quickly.
But, you know, so there's all this chaos going on. But think about this. Here's Lot, again, having gone doing this number, and now he's like, I'll endanger myself to go chase after my sons-in-law. So this is like, wait, okay, it's godly almost again. He's willing to suffer. He won't suffer for his daughters, but he'll go out and suffer for his sons-in-laws, it seems. And he says, up, get out of this place, for the Lord is about to destroy the city. But he seemed to his sons-in-laws to be jesting. And the root there, you know what that word literally means? The jesting in Hebrew, it's yetzak, which is the same Hebrew word as laughter. So let's go back and let's think about it. God comes to Abraham and says, I'm going to make good on my promise. Abraham
laughs.
He goes to Sarah and says, no, you're still the one. I'm going to come through on my promise to you. And Sarah
laughs.
There's a destruction coming. You need to leave. And they laugh. And so laughter, which is the name Isaac, and Israel, the name Isaac would be Yitzhak. And the idea is everybody's laughing at God. They laugh at his promises. They laugh at his offers of mercy. They laugh at his destruction. They laugh at everything. Nobody is taking God seriously here. And so verse 15, as morning dawned, the angels urged Lot, saying, up, take your wife and your two daughters who are here, lest you be swept away in the punishment of the city. So, like, you could not get more, like, intense after what just happened. Like, I doubt you're sleeping well that night. Everything about this is, like, your nerves are going, everything else. And now the angels are like, you need to hurry. This whole city is about to be utterly wiped out. What's the next line?
The best.
But he lingered. Like, what are you doing? Like, this is so frustrating. But
he even has no self-preservation. Like, even if he's not a bad guy, he should care about himself a little more in this scenario. Like, he's about to be smited, and he has the option to get out.
But how often do you come across somebody whose decisions have led them into destruction? Like, they're in the middle of destruction, and you go to them, and you're like, man, there's an extension of mercy. Christ offers you a new life, a new beginning, a clean slate, righteousness, forgiveness of sins. You could have it all, and you don't know if you're promised tomorrow, so grab hold of it while you can. And how many people have the same stupid reaction as Lot?
Yeah.
I did. I lingered. I was like, yeah, but not yet. I'm not ready to walk away from all the things that I'm engaged in. And you know what happens? Like, because our God is good enough, he pretty much had to do the same thing that these angels do with Lot and his wife and daughters. So the men, the angels, seized him and his wife and his two daughters by the hand, and the Lord being merciful to him, they brought him out and set him outside the city. So they don't even, it's like God is like, You're not worthy of this. Like, I'm offering you mercy. And they're like, yeah, I don't know. Like, we still have some business deals to tend to here. We're not ready to leave. You know, Sodom is kind of our comfort place. And he's like, no, I'm going to drag you.
I'm evicting
you out of the city. And there were a lot of parts of my conversion, like, where it was like, he had to bring me kicking and screaming to recognize he was the very best thing for me, and that I needed to leave Egypt and Sodom and all the things that were, you know, eating my soul from the inside out. But again, like, in the middle of this story of destruction, like, pay attention to how much mercy God is seeking to extend. We read right past it. It's all over the place.
And that's why those kinds of warnings make me judgy against the guy like Lot, because his was physical. So I think when it's like the physical, like, yeah, fire's going to rain down, you should be more aware. Whereas ours, this is a little sneakier. Yeah. Like, our destruction.
There will be a day when the fire's coming.
Yeah, so our destruction's a little sneakier. It's a little harder to pick up. But it's there.
So next comes one of the verses that I think is so, like, we tend to read it literally, and it makes the Lord look petty, but I want to suggest something. So verse 17, he's dragged them out of the city, or the angels have, and as they brought them out, one of them said, escape for your life. Like, this is life and death. Escape for your life. And he says, do not look back or stop anywhere in the valley. Escape to the hills, lest you be swept away. And how do most people imagine this command?
Like, I literally just...
Yeah. Don't sneak a peek. Like, don't look. It's like Medusa. If you look at her, you turn to stone, right? Which I wonder where that myth came from. But anyway... Like, that, think about this. Like, it's not saying don't, you know, literally turn back. It's saying where you're looking is where your affections are, right? Don't look back. Leave it behind. You got a new life in front of you. I want you to go. I don't want you to stop anywhere in the valley. I want you to move ahead. And so Lot says to them, again, Lot, come on. Lot said to them, verse 18, Oh, no, my lords, behold, your servant has found favor in your sight. So he recognizes, like, I don't deserve this.
Yeah, that was helpful.
Yeah, so, okay, you get that part. And you have shown me great kindness in saving my life. Okay, so he recognizes he dies if he stays there. But I can't escape to the hills, lest disaster overtake me and I die. In other words, like, do you know the life I had in Sodom? Like, if I go to the hills, what's in the hills?
I have a standard of living, angels.
Exactly. That's it. Like, do you know what I've built? Like, you want me to walk away from that? Like, what's in the hills? Like, I lose all the normal things that I have. I lose my sustenance. I lose the business I've built, the authority that I have. I lose everything I've ever had. Like, I can't live out there. And so this is where you're like, okay, God, like, just cut them loose. You know, cut the line.
Yeah, no more advice.
And so he starts negotiating. He says, oh, you know, behold, this city's near enough to flee to. And it's just a little one. I don't want to be out in the wilderness depending on you. I don't want to go to the hills where there's no people to industry to have. He's like, you know, just give me, I'll just want a little city. Let me escape there. Isn't it a little one and my life will be saved? Like, so what does he count his life as?
Just stuff.
I need a city. Like, they're like, hey, we're saving your life. And he's like, yeah, if you really want to save my life, give me, you know, a little city. You know, I won't be like Sodom greedy, but give me Zoar over there, that little city. And so he said to him, behold, I grant you this favor also, that I will not overthrow the city of which you have spoken. And the angels are like, and mercy, again, you can go there. Escape there quickly, for I can do nothing till you arrive there. Therefore, the name of the city was called Zoar, which means low or lowly or little. And the sun has risen on the earth when Lot came to Zoar. Then, now hear this, then the Lord rained on Sodom and Gomorrah. Like, we haven't heard much about Gomorrah.
Yeah, why does that just get thrown in?
I don't know. So there's five of the, remember when the four major empires go up against the five little tribal chieftains and they get conquered? It's Sodom, Gomorrah, and then three others. I guess Gomorrah is the next biggest one. But it's like there's no players in Gomorrah. It's just, I guess it's in the blast of what God
is
going
to. Just be the same thing.
Yeah. So rained on Sodom and Gomorrah, sulfur and fire from the Lord out of heaven. And he overthrew those cities and all the valley and all the inhabitants of the city and what grew on the ground. Hang on to that. And now I want to take a pause and let's go look at what they've discovered in like archaeology. So we talked about Stephen Collins, who has discovered this place, Tell El Hammam, that it matches everything about Sodom, right? We know it's the size matches fortifications, the type of architecture is different, the network of surrounding towns show that this was the centerpiece like Sodom would have been. And something happened where this city gets utterly destroyed by fire. The archaeologists say that it left the city uninhabited from being like the major city of the region, suddenly uninhabited and uninhabitable 700 years after a fiery destruction.
Wow.
And so just to show like the size of this place, it's five times bigger than Jericho. It has 62 acres inside 18 feet thick walls. So to go back to this particular time period, 3,700 plus years ago, this is a massively fortified city. You're not messing, like, for the region, Sodom's a big, big deal.
And that means it wasn't just like a couple of guys that had a screw loose in the city.
That's correct.
You know what I'm saying? It's not like, oh, this city was just made of 12 wicked men. We shouldn't think about this as a deal. No, this is a real place.
So the outcry of the region, you can imagine, if that's the big city and what it's exporting and what it's importing. And,
well, we got to go to Sodom to do business. What does that mean?
Yeah. Yeah, wow. Yeah, you can imagine the outcry would have been huge. So one of the things that they found when they were digging is all of the buildings and everything else are bent to the northeast. Like they're just, which like they're like that and a bunch of other evidence shows this was hit by from something up above. You know, it says that God rained down fire and brimstone or sulfur, and they were like, this whole region has been demolished by a meteor that exploded. And there's evidence of that. So you see that like Forbes magazine, Newsweek, the Times of Israel, Yahoo News. Like when this came out, they were like, oh my goodness, there's evidence of Sodom. Newsweek, the biblical city of Sodom was blasted to smithereens by a massive asteroid explosion. And the reason why they all said that is there's a bunch of evidence and it shows that an asteroid came, exploded over the northern side of the Dead Sea. So Sodom's just to the north of the Dead Sea. meteor comes, explodes over the Dead Sea, and sends all of its shrapnel, the shards of sulfur and brimstone and everything else that just peppers that whole region. And all the buildings are pushed over. One of the first places that they uncovered was called the Red Palace because it was burned, and it was burned from above. They had to remove like feet of ash in this place. And you're like, okay, well, great. A city got, you know, destroyed. It was burned. Like, what's the evidence? This is from University of South Carolina Archaeology and Anthropology Institute, where they're like, the evidence that this was hit by a meteor, this was no normal little flare that came through. Like, this was a massive destruction event. So let me just read from their report. Kind of wild. They had no idea an unseen icy space rock was speeding toward them at about 38,000 miles an hour. Flashing through the atmosphere, the rock exploded in a massive fireball about 2.5 miles above ground. The blast was about 1,000 times more powerful than the Hiroshima atomic bomb. The shocked city dwellers who stared at it were instantly blinded. Air temperatures rapidly rose above 3,600 degrees Fahrenheit. Clothing and wood immediately burst into flames. Swords, spears, mud bricks, pottery began to melt. They're finding all this stuff. Almost immediately, the entire city was on fire. Some seconds later, a massive shockwave smashed into the city. Moving at about 740 miles per hour, it was more powerful than the worst tornado ever recorded. Deadly winds ripped through the city, demolishing every building, which they've uncovered. They sheared off the top of 40 feet of the four-story palace and blew the jumbled debris into the next valley. None of the 8,000 people or any of the animals within the city survived. Their bodies were torn apart, their bones blasted into small fragments.
Well,
like, this is no joke, right? And so we know that that happened there. So some of the other stuff that I think is just absolutely fascinating to give you perspective on what the city faced in this region is they found pottery shards that were, like, blistered. But they were blistered in a way to where they were called trinitite rocks. Now, it's called trinitite rocks because in 1945, when they were doing the atomic blast testing, it was Trinity, like that was the explosion, and the heat and pressure generated from the atomic bomb testing left trinitite rocks blistered. That's what you find in the ruins of this ancient mound of Sodom. So it requires heat above 2,000 degrees, which is hotter than magma. It's hotter than the average house fire. So it's not like some invaders just set the place on fire. That only That gets to like 1,100 degrees. This is over 2,000 degrees. Meteoric stones peppered the ground, creating diamondoids. So they find these little things that are so like crushed with pressure, strong that it actually creates like little diamondoids. The sand is crushed into shocked quartz and cracked, which like the scientists that are looking at this are like, holy moly, like that requires 725,000 pounds per square inch to create shocked quartz like that.
Wow.
150 pickup trucks stacked on your thumb. That's the equivalent of that. And so all of this, you know, and they're looking at the ruins and they find pockmarks where the sulfur rocks are like peppered all over the place. You see it in like the ruins of bones and in the buildings and pottery, like little pockmarks where it was literally raining down fire and rocks that just decimated the city. Now, one of the interesting things on top of that is it says that it fell upon the land, right? Now, when it says it destroyed all that grew on the ground, one of the things that they found in their report is that when this meteor comes and it explodes over the Dead Sea, right? Which then the shockwave pushes down into the Dead Sea and then shoves that all over the land. What's unique about the Dead Sea?
It's salty.
Oh, that's right. You got this a rock from the Dead Sea. Well done.
It's a salt rock.
That's a good little prop. So you find that all over the place because this thing is 9 times more salty.
It's salty, folks.
Than the oceans. If you go in there and like they tell ladies that not to shave your legs before you go in there, because it will burn.
Yeah, you figure out if you have any cuts.
Yeah. Yeah, you know all the guys that have hemorrhoids, you're welcome. Because that salt, like, will light you on fire. It is super salty. You, like, float way above the water. It's kind of a bizarre...
It's a weird experience.
Experience. So now imagine a meteor exploding, hitting that massively salty region, and then it shoves all this melted and evaporated salt all over the land.
At 740 miles per hour.
That's right. Do you know what, in the ancient world, what they would do to enemies' territories after they conquered them?
Salt it.
They salted them. So they would take salt and they would scatter it all over the farmlands, because if you salt somebody's fields, nothing ever grows there again. Now, this gets to the answer that when Lot looks across the Jordan Valley and he says, oh, I want that land, it's well-watered like the garden of the Lord. In Lot's day and age, he's looking at a land that's lush, it's Edenic, it's garden-like, until, right? And then you shove this massive shockwave of salt all over it, and now nothing grows there. Mm. So now they go to all the surrounding territories, and listen to this is a direct report from their findings with other scientists adding in. It says it devastated approximately 500 square kilometers immediately north of the Dead Sea, including Tell el-Hammam, which is the Sodom place, with a superheated brine of Dead Sea anhydride salts pushed over the landscape by the event's frontal shockwave. So just imagine that salt just covering everything. A geochemical analysis of 6 soil and ash samples revealed that salt and sulfate levels were greater than 6% in the ash layer, more than 5% in the soil layers immediately above and below the ash layer. So do you know at what point the salt content, you can't grow crops on it ever again? Like, you, it will not allow you to grow crops. If you have 12,800 parts per million, you cannot get seeds to germinate. And this is saying between 50 and 60,000 parts per million. Wow. Is what the salt content is in the soil. Well, how did it get there? They know that it's from this explosion that then covered everything with this melted anhydrite, dehydrated salt that just covered everything and stuck to all the plants and killed it all. So that's going to become later on, like if a huge salt blast is going over this region, what else in the story do you find that is associated with salt?
Lot's wife.
Lot's wife. That's interesting. It's an interesting theory. So why did they associate her with salt? That'll be an interesting theory anyway. So Deuteronomy 29:23 says the whole land burned with brimstone and salt. So when Moses talks about this in Deuteronomy, he says it's brimstone and salt, nothing sown and nothing growing where no plant can sprout. That's Deuteronomy 29:23. So the Bible is like, yep, salt was put all over that region. Well, yes. Yes, it was. So in this, you see in verse 26, but Lot's wife behind him looked back and she became a pillar of salt. And so the way that I always understood this, like we talked about, was like Lot's wife is walking along, hears a noise, looks back at Sodom, and God goes, ha, gotcha. You know, and she turns into salt, just like
a salt snowman.
Yeah. And she's just frozen in time and salt. So this is where I would say, like, when she turns and looks back, the Hebrew verb there, nabat, can mean to look, to gaze, or to regard. Hmm. So it's like, you know, the Bible says, keep your eyes fixed on Jesus. Like, what does that mean? It's not like, okay, the where test is of faith he? Is like, all right, I'm not, you know, this is like a staring contest. It's saying, set your affections on him. Keep him as the object of your affections, right? So when it's talking about Lot's wife looking back, it's not like God's going, ha ha, she turned. I saw her right there.
I saw it.
Turned to salt. It's she loved Sodom. She wanted to go back. Her heart was there. She was not wanting to follow God. She stopped. She didn't want the salvation. And she literally turned back because her heart was set on Sodom, not on the Lord. And, you know, whether or not that blast of anhydride salts literally turns her, covers her and encapsulates her in salt or burns her and reduces her to salt, like for whatever reason, she was associated with salt for getting back into the blast radius. And Jesus, let's go to Luke's description of this, because when he describes the second coming, Listen to what he says about it, because he says it's going to be like Sodom. Listen to what he says. It was Luke 17, verse 28. Likewise, just as it was in the days of Lot, they were eating and drinking and buying and selling and planting and building. But on the day when Lot went out from Sodom, fire and sulfur rained from heaven and destroyed them all. So it will be on the day when the Son of Man is revealed. Now listen to what he says, because it's not like, you know, where are people looking? He says, on that day, let no one who is on the housetop with his goods in the house not come down and take them away. And likewise, let the one who's in the field not turn back. What's he saying? Don't have regard for all your stuff.
Yeah, don't go
back. Like, the person on the roof can't be like, oh, my stuff, I got to go grab it. The person who's out in the field can't be like, oh, my money, you know, I need to run back in. So when Jesus is interpreting and giving you the practical application of what's going on here, what he's saying is, you can't love your stuff more than God. Mm. You can't love your comforts. You can't love what you built here more than you love God. What's Lot's wife's problem? He goes on in verse 32 of that passage, and he says, remember Lot's wife. And then he drops this very famous line. Whoever seeks to preserve his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life will keep it. What does that mean? Lot's wife wanted to keep her old life.
She ran back to it.
She lost it. Everything, my whole gaze, all my affections are back there. And so she turns literally into a pillar of salt and loses her soul, loses her future. And what Jesus' practical application of the Sodom story is don't hesitate. Get out of the city. God has told you a judgment is coming. Lean into his mercy. Go with him. Be willing to walk away from all the other petty idols and to go with him wherever he calls you. So now we're back to Genesis 19, picking up in verse 27. It says, Abraham went early in the morning to the place where he had stood before the Lord. So now Abram, you know, you wake up and there's all this commotion. You feel the earth shaking and like something's going on.
It's probably a little warm over there.
if you're Abraham, you know destruction's coming. So you're waiting for it. So early in the morning, he goes and stands where he had been before the Lord. And he looked down from a mountaintop and he looks toward Sodom and Gomorrah and toward all the land of the valley. And he looked and behold, the smoke of the land went up like the smoke of a furnace. And it's like, man, look at that power. Look at what God has just done, like his holiness being mocked, and he's just scorched it. So Abraham is sitting there. He's got to be wondering, like, I hope Lot got out.
Yeah, he never knows, right? I mean, we never see clear, like, they never have a reunion.
Not in
Scripture.
There's think so. Like, I'm trying to think if Abraham's birth Lot comes. I don't think he does. So I don't think so. I think this is
This is also an Abraham and God moment where now Abraham's wondering, like,
yeah,
man, did God kill my nephew?
Yeah, but listen to where it goes, because you know why Lot was saved? The Bible tells us. It says, so it was, this is verse 29, so it was that when God destroyed the cities of the valley, what? God remembered Abraham and sent Lot out of the midst of the overthrow when he overthrew the cities in which Lot had lived. Why is Lot alive?
Abraham.
I think because Abraham interceded for him. Because
he's a mediator.
He's a mediator. He's a priest that's looking at somebody who's in the midst of backsliding or whatever. He has just a tiny little mustard seed of faith. And Abraham's like, please, you know, please, for the sake of the righteous, will you spare? And God goes there and is willing. Like, God's willing to honor that and be like, anybody, not even the righteous, like, I'll show mercy to the wicked if you'll just come.
Yeah.
And Lot survives because he belonged to Abraham. I think in and of himself, you know, I think he caught faith from Abraham, walking with him, watching Abraham lean into the Lord and whatever he did to where it was like, that behavior is wicked and I think I should show favor and hospitality to the angels of God. And oh, by the way, I've got every man from Sodom and I've got these two angels. He fears heaven more than all the men outside of his door. So like whatever faith, however messed up that is, it was enough for God to show mercy and enough for the New Testament to say he's righteous Lot. And so what I want to do now is this is going to present a pattern for all the major judgments to come. And we're going to go through this quick and then we're going to shut down, I think. But if you think about Sodom being, since the flood, the first major judgment that comes onto the world, all the, it's like a telescope where all of them are the same tube, but they come out a little bit differently as they go. So let's take Sodom, the judgment upon Egypt when God delivers the Israelites out of Egypt, the judgment that God pours out upon Jericho with Joshua in the Battle of Jericho, and then we'll look at Revelation and the final judgment, because they all tell the same story, just different iterations of it. So you ready? Here's how it goes. God sends two messengers to offer mercy, to offer salvation, to plead with people to turn, or somebody saved as a result of these two messengers. There's always salvation behind a
door.
Then there's going to be deliverance. There's going to be judgment. Then after the judgment, there's going to be somebody who says, but I want to go back because I love that more. And then God's final judgment falls. All right? Okay. So we've got two messengers, salvation behind a door, Lot's family or people being delivered. Somebody wants to go back to the old way, and then God brings judgment. So think about those things. Sodom, let's walk through them. How many angels?
Two. That was a quiz question at the end of this podcast. Did you listen?
When did the door come into play?
When he put him inside.
Yeah, the angels grab Lot, shut the door. Everyone outside's blinded. And by the way, everyone outside, judged. But inside, you have somebody who ends up being like, oh, I don't like walking with the Lord. I want to go back. And God's judgment falls on the wicked city, right? So now we jump to Egypt. What do you know here? How many people go pleading?
Oh, Moses and Aaron.
Aaron, right? You got the two guys. When do you find a door?
The blood on the doorposts.
Everybody behind the door is marked for salvation. Everybody without blood marked on their door is marked for judgment and loses the firstborn. Then you get the Hebrews that are going to be God's people that are going to be delivered out. And when do you find the people being like, well, yeah, I don't like it on here. I didn't go back.
Instantly and all the time.
It's really true. Like, oh, we had pots of meat in Egypt. You brought us out here to kill us. We want to go back to Egypt. We liked our slavery. Like, and so they all die out in the wilderness, and God brings judgment on Egypt, right?
Mm-hmm.
Let's jump to Jericho. How many spies?
Well, there's two faithful ones.
No, not that go in to scout out the land of Israel. The spies sent into the city of Jericho that end up hiding in Rahab's house, there's two of them. And they make a promise that everyone behind Rahab's door is going to live with the scarlet hanging out the window. And then they end up conquering the city. They come out, all the treasures are there. And then God, there's one guy that's like, oh, I just can't turn away from the treasures of that city. Like, I don't want to obey God. I want all the stuff. Who's that? You remember the name?
Achan.
And God brings judgment on Achan, and Jericho is destroyed. So you see the pattern here. Now, when you get to the book of Revelation, and it's talking about the apocalypse, gee, I wonder what's going to happen. It's like God's not in for suspense novels. It's like, he kind of tells you what it's going to look like, right? In Revelation 11:3, how many witnesses are sent to bring the warning?
I mean, there better be two at this point.
It's two. You are correct. And what is the door? I mean, in Revelation it says, behold, I stand at the door and knock. And how does that go? If anybody will open up and come in and dine with me, like, I'll have them. But if you are on the other side of the door,
judgment.
It's not good for you. Jesus says flat out, I am the door.
Which is the weirdest one he says, and it makes no sense until you think about it like this.
Yeah, I mean, so in shepherd terms, that's what he's talking. I'm the door. If you're on the inside of me, you are going to be saved. But if you're on the outside of me, if you're on the outside of what's marked with blood, like, there is judgment for you. And so then when you get through and you start getting into the later chapters of Revelation, when the judgment starts to fall, like Revelation chapter 18 and 19, there's people that are being called out of the wicked world, called out of the wicked city, and they're dressed as a bride prepared for their husband, and they're all coming out, and it's just singing and praising in Revelation 19. They have their eyes so firmly fixed on Jesus. They're just in awe of who he is. They can't wait to be with him forever. It's the greatest day of their life. And in the previous chapter, when it talks about fire falling on Babylon and it being overthrown in a single day, what are all those people doing? Because the Bible tells you that their eyes are fixed somewhere. And you know where they're fixed? All their eyes are looking at Babylon. And you know what they're mourning? all of our wealth, all the stuff we built, all the goods and services and our comfortable life, and they're all weeping and wailing as God's bride is singing and rejoicing for a wedding day, they're having the worst day of their lives because their eyes are pointed in the wrong direction. They've looked back. Like, don't do that. Like, fix your eyes on Jesus. He is the hope. He is your salvation. And oh, by the way, the great Babylon falls by fire. And so you see, I mean, that's just four examples of this judgment where you find that. And the story of Sodom kind of launches that off. So if you remember last time, like, we talked about how odd it is that the Bible doesn't just say, oh, Sodom, those wicked people who do, you know, immoral stuff. And, you know, you wonder what the Bible is accusing them of. And I do want to address that, by the way, because Ezekiel comes and says it's not just sexual sin. It is that. But Ezekiel 16:49 says, like, after God has been speaking about Jerusalem, he says, behold, this was the guilt of your sister Sodom. So in God's eyes, he's looking at these religious people. We talked about this last time. And he says, Sodom's like your sister. She and her daughters had pride. Like, if you're mounting up the sins of Sodom, pride, excess of food, prosperous ease, but did not aid the poor and the needy. They were haughty. So it's like, how much of that description? And then he gets, and they did an abomination. Now, anybody who tries to point at this and say that Ezekiel's saying, oh, sin, you know, the sexual part wasn't the sin. Not the entirety.
Yeah.
But when it says abomination, that's a specific word that later on, when you get to Leviticus 18 and 20, guess what God refers to homosexuality as?
Abomination.
An abomination. Guess or men dressing as women also. And Deuteronomy is referred to as an abomination. And so when you get into this, like, clearly it's those things. But it's when he says they were haughty and did an abomination before me. He's referring to that, I'm convinced. And so I removed them when I saw it. That's from the words of Ezekiel. And so in one sense, you've got, okay, yeah, we can look at a men that are willing to rape others and be like, oh, yeah, clearly that's wicked. That's worthy of judgment. And then Ezekiel's like, well, hold on a minute. And they were greedy, and they were proud, and they didn't care for the poor, and they exploited those around them. And we're like, hey, hold on a minute. Like, I'm not too bad at those
getting
things,
a little closer.
Right? But yeah. He's like, hey, Jerusalem, the holy city, that's your sister. And you're like, whoa, 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 hold on. Whoa. And it's like, in both of those directions, you have the wicked, the licentious, and you have the legalist over here. And as we said last time, both of them miss the mark. Both of them have their eyes fixed on themselves, not on the Lord. And so, like, if there's one thing, I think, to take away from this, like, if you're sitting in your chair right now, or you're driving around listening to the podcast, or wherever it is that you watch this or listen to it, and you're going, man, am I like one of the people from Sodom that's like super corrupt morally? Like, there's one answer for you, which is run to Jesus.
Yeah.
Like, there's mercy in the midst of Sodom. Like, come. Yeah. Like, he's offering mercy in the midst of Sodom. Come. And if you think of yourself being like, oh my gosh, like, yeah, I might not be in Sodom, but I'm Sodom's sister. I'm like Jerusalem. I'm self-righteous.
Need that deliverance.
I don't need that deliverance. I'm good enough. I've got it all figured out. And you're the self-righteous person that Jesus seems to have a bigger issue with anyway. Like, he's always getting after it with the self-righteous people. If that's you, guess what the answer is? Run to Jesus. In every situation, what's the answer? Run to Jesus. If you're so licentious and you think, man, I've done so many bad things, God could never forgive someone like me. I'm too far gone. Like, he's in the middle of Sodom with angels that are attempting to be taken advantage of, raped by these guys. And he's like, see if they'll accept mercy. Do you hear the heart of God in that?
Yeah, and righteous Lot.
Right? And then over here, you have Jesus who's looking at a self-righteous city in his own lifetime that he knows is going to betray them out of a sense of self-righteousness. And he's weeping over them saying, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, I've longed to gather you to myself like a hen gathers chicks under her wings, but you were not willing. Be willing. If you're in Sodom, if you find yourself in a Sodom situation, grab hold of the mercy. It's there for you. And he offers it with joy. And if you're in the middle of the Jerusalem saying, I don't need a savior, humble yourself. The greatest thing you could do for the heart of God, to thrill the heart of God, is to say, I need you. And I'm going to humble myself and recognize I need your mercy, because it's readily available to you. And it's readily available with joy. I was just talking with somebody who was like, I just don't know. I feel so unworthy of it. Like, he's getting a bad deal. He doesn't want me. And it's like, you know, the parable where it says, if a man has 100 sheep and he leaves the 99 to chase after the one, like, when he finds the one in that parable, he's more happy and thrilled about the one. There's the party in heaven. All the angels rejoice. And he's more thrilled with the one that's finally come home than with the 99. It's like, that's God's heart toward the lost. He wants you. You want to please him? Don't sit around and beat yourself up.
Yeah.
Thrill his heart by saying, I want you too. And I need you.
It's good.
Amen?
Amen.
All right. So, grab hold of Jesus while you can, because the day of fire, we never know when it's coming. And when that day comes, have a heart that is so ready to be with him and all that he promises that you're not tempted like Lot's wife to look back and say, oh, but everything I lose, he's worth way more than all of it put together. So we're going to leave it there. We want to thank you so much for watching. Join us next time as we get into another story where Lot's life seems to devolve a little bit more, and yet God once again is going to do something exceptionally beautiful to bring redemption out of even Lot's mess. God bless. Thanks for listening to The Bible Show. If you enjoyed this podcast, please remember to like and subscribe and leave a kind review to help us in the world of tech algorithms. Also, feel free to share with a friend. We'll see you next week with another episode of The Bible Show.